Which are now on the conference line. Mr. Green, I'll turn the meeting over to you.
Thank you, Danita, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to How to Develop Portable Applications. I'm David Green with the HP2000 Customer Communications Program, and I want to thank you for joining us for the next installment in our continuing series of audio conference seminars. We hope to do in the next hour is give you a clearer picture of how you can begin to address one of today's top information challenges, developing portable applications. Now, increasingly, portable applications are being promoted as a response to a whole wide range of issues that are coming up in the information systems environment, including things like the growing complexity of computing environments, the demands to improve the efficiency of productivity of end users, and the need to reduce costs in the information systems organization. And while there is wide agreement that portability and portable applications can help address these issues, there's far less agreement as to the strategies that should be used to effectively implement such applications. And those strategies are what we're really going to focus on today. We want to start to prepare you to take the first steps towards building portable applications by looking at the strategies and the tools that are necessary to put that together. Now, in preparation for the program, you should all have received in the mail a participant's information packet, and in that you'll find copies of the overhead slides that we're referring to as we go along in the program today. If you open that pack up to page 2, you'll see listed out the specific objectives that we hope to achieve. Really, our overall goal here is to, as I mentioned, give you the information you need and the knowledge you need to take those first couple steps in the development process. And specifically, that means we're going to review common strategies for developing portable applications. We're going to define criteria for evaluating application development strategies, as well as the tools for implementing those strategies. And we also want to share with you a case study that shows what an HP3000 customer is doing in their environment using a 4GL to develop portable applications. The agenda for today's program really follows directly from these objectives. Well, we'll start with an overview of the development strategies, and then look at our first strategy using standards and third-generation languages. The close-up on standards and third-generation languages is really going to focus on some of the standards that you need to include in your solution. We'll then shift our focus to our second strategy using fourth-generation languages, and there we're really going to focus our attention on establishing a framework for evaluating fourth-generation languages. We'll conclude with our segment, with our case study of the Communications Technology Center for Washington State, and then we will turn the program over to all of you to answer your questions. So if you do have any questions along the way in today's program, please just make a note of those, and we'll have time to answer those at the end. Now, as a way of getting started, I think it's useful to take a step back and kind of look at the vision and the reality of portable applications today. And if you look at page 4 in your packet, you'll see what in many ways is the ultimate portability vision, that you should be able to take an application that you've developed for any client or any server that uses any database management system or network or user interface, and take that application without modification, run it on any other client or any other server or any other database management system. That's really what we're all setting out to do. Now, unfortunately, as many of you may have discovered firsthand, the reality today is considerably less elegant than this. In fact, achieving even the first stages of this vision, even a piece of this vision, does require overcoming some significant challenges, and we've outlined some of those on page 5. Often, portable applications are significantly more complex to develop than non-portable applications. It's a new world, a world full of rules and restrictions. That's the nature of standards that require portability, and you need to work within those. Development tools are still rapidly evolving, as are many of the portability standards, and in many cases, there are really no clear market winners that could be considered the long-term leader. There's limited expertise available in the marketplace. And this is all made more challenging by vendors, and HP is included in this, who continue to add their unique value added to standards-based implementations that make their solution somewhat less portable. So really, putting all this together, we're not telling you all this in a way of discouraging portability or discouraging portable applications, but as you launch into portable applications, it is important to keep in mind the reality of what's out there today. Nonetheless, the benefits of implementing portable applications are compelling and can be significant to organizations. They include things like lowering the implementation cost of your application. You can develop the application once on one platform and implement it then across platforms throughout the organization. You're able to lower support and management costs as application development processes become standardized, as interfaces become standardized, and the same applications are running across systems. End-user training costs can be reduced. End-users can become familiar with a single consistent set of interface standards across applications. And finally, you begin to achieve a degree of hardware independence that gives you flexibility and freedom for the future. So then with these items in mind, I think it's time to focus in on the strategies that we're going to use to start to achieve some of these benefits and start to build some of these applications. And to do this, let's start with just an overview of the strategies. I'd like to welcome George Sacknick to our program. George is responsible for HP 3000 technical and support training. And if you've been out in the field, if you've met someone who's talking to you that is an expert on POSIX or portable applications, chances are most of what they learned came from George. So we thought we'd put you in touch here with the source. So George, really, before we get into any of the details, can you talk about application portability in terms of what is available today? What are the different degrees of portability, and what can people expect to achieve?
Well, thanks, David. And I think we should begin by talking about not what portability is so much as what it isn't. Today, in the multi-user computer world, there are a lot of people have expectations that we're moving towards the same sort of portability you see in the PC world, where you can buy shrink-wrapped software in your friendly neighborhood computer store, and it'll run on your PC regardless of whether you bought it from Hewlett-Packard, IBM, or Radio Shack, or it doesn't much matter. That's an area that, if that's going to happen in the multi-user world, it's quite a ways away yet. There is no standard that I'm aware of that's developed for that level of chip portability. What we do see, however, today in the multi-user computer world, and the commercial world in particular, is source code portability, where you can write a single set of source code that will compile across multiple platforms. And this is the goal of many of the standards, including the POSIX standard that we're talking about here today.
But now, George, given that we're all trying to get source code portability, what really are the strategies that can be followed to create applications that give you source code portability?
Well, we've identified two, actually, David. The first one is revolves around standards, industry standards for source code, and third-generation languages such as C, Fortran, and COBOL. So the idea is to create programs using these languages that will run on any platform once you've compiled it with the appropriate compiler on that particular platform. The second strategy is revolves around fourth generation languages, where you sort of lift yourself up a level of abstraction above the third generation languages, the traditional languages that we've used on the 3000 in the past. And instead of relying on your hardware vendor to provide portability, you rely on the vendor who sold you the fourth generation language. Once again, the applications written in this way can run on any platform that's supported by that language. And again, the goal is the same, is you're trying to achieve source code portability.
Okay, well, now, as we noted up front, really one of the goals of today's program is to evaluate these two strategies, and obviously we're going to need to talk about both of them in more detail before we can really do that, but there's on page 10 we've listed out some of the criteria that are going to be involved in this evaluation process. Can you kind of review these just to get everybody started thinking about how this evaluation is going to happen?
Sure, and we are going to go into these in more detail over the next 30 minutes or so, but there are basically six criteria that we've identified: performance, time to market, cost, flexibility, end-user ease of use, and vendor independence. And so in each of these criteria, we'll focus on the advantages and disadvantages offered by both 3GLs and 4GLs. Now, let's take a look at the first strategy then, business with standards and third-generation languages. What we're seeing here is an attempt to create programs, as we mentioned, with these third-generation languages such as C, Fortran, and COBOL. And what really makes this work, I think, is the ability to the emergence of standards in operating systems, so that there's a single set of interfaces to various operating systems that are out there. So as you write your program, you can write it once, and it'll port easily to multiple platforms.
But I think, George, that there's a perception that kind of standard has already kind of been turned by the marketplace, and that Unix is the standard for portable application development. Is that true? And what are you talking about here?
Well, Unix, I think, is there's a lot of people who believe that Unix is the standard, and I think what's actually more true in today's marketplace, at least, is that Unix is the place where the standards are coming from. But I think it would be a mistake to say that it is the standard. You know, if you look at the evolution of the Unix operating system, back in the 1960s, actually, it was developed at Bell Labs as a hardware-independent operating system, evolved through the 1970s, and Bell had the foresight to write that operating system in a relatively portable language, specifically in C. So once you'd written a C compiler for a particular platform, the whole Unix operating system followed relatively quickly after that. Now, the problem is that as various vendors, HP, Digital Equipment, Sun, and so forth, license the Unix source code from AT&T, one of the first things that many of them decided to do, as hardware vendors will, is enhance it so that they could stand up in the marketplace, beat their chest proudly, and say, my Unix is better than yours. Well, that's fine, except for the problem that once a programmer takes advantage of an enhancement to Unix that's available on one platform but not on another, then there's a subsequent decline in portability of that application from the platform where you started to any other platform that might not support those enhancements. So in an effort to address that, an organization called IEEE, which is the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, decided to come up with a standard, not for the operating system, not for Unix itself, but for the interfaces into Unix, which if you're an application programmer is really the only part of the operating system that you care about. And so the committees that were formed created this hardware, this standard for the operating intersystems, and the set of standards collectively is referred to as the POSIX standards, and we'll talk about those in a couple of minutes. But what all of this means is that if you look on page 13, down the left-hand side of this chart, you could see that what happened at the beginning of this decade is most vendors of application software standardized on Unix as their development environment. Unix supports a very strong set of development tools, and so the next generation of applications that were being developed by these people were originally targeted with Unix as their runtime platform. But at the same time, over on the right-hand side of this chart, you can see proprietary systems like MPE began evolving into open systems. That is, we added open systems interfaces, industry standard interfaces, to MPE. So from the point of view of the application program, the application wouldn't have to know or care whether it was running on an MPE system or on a Unix system. So we feel that as we roll into the middle of this decade, what we are going to be seeing is an emerging set of common open applications, and some of these are already available today, that can run on either platform. And that really gives the proprietary customers a decided advantage, because only on the open proprietary platforms can you run both kinds of applications. You can continue to run your business on your legacy applications if that turns out to be desirable, and at the same time you can use these new open tools to either enhance those applications or, if it's in your interest, to even completely replace them over time at your own speed.
Okay, well, let's start to dig with that as kind of background. Let's dig a little deeper into the standards that are required for portable applications. You mentioned POSIX a couple of times, George. Is that really all that's required for building portable applications?
Oh, certainly not. The POSIX standards as they exist today are really fairly limited. Basically, the POSIX standards that exist that have already been finalized by IEEE address only very simple kinds of operating system functionality. So they define the interface between an application program and the operating system itself. So they allow you to do things like work with files, not databases, just flat files. You can run a program using POSIX standard interfaces, things like that. If you want additional functionality, for example, most commercial applications do require some level of database functionality. There are standard ways of doing that. For example, the ANSI SQL standard that we mentioned on page 14 here is an industry standard way of updating databases, which applies to virtually all the third-party databases that are out there today. Certainly applies to Allbase, and now with the Image SQL enhancement that's out there. You can even work with TurboImage using that standard. Networking standards, we've seen a real transition in the last few years from proprietary interfaces to networks to industry standard interfaces into networks, such as the Berkeley Sockets interfaces, which means that your application program is then portable from one kind of network to another. Now, the interesting thing is what all of this means is that the typical commercial application is built on multiple standards. So if you look at the picture on page 15, you can see the sort of sawtooth-looking box up here at the top of this chart represents the application, and it does not interface with the underlying system strictly via the operating system, but there are industry standard interfaces for the database, as we mentioned, for the network, perhaps for the user interface, as well as interfaces to the operating system. And the operating system interfaces come in two flavors. There's the open POSIX, typically operating system interfaces, as well as proprietary interfaces. Most commercial applications these days make use of all of these. Now, the key thing that you want to keep in mind if you're developing in this environment is, particularly with the proprietary system calls, you want to have those localized. In fact, if at all possible, you want to have all your operating system interfaces localized in one library. Because if it does become necessary to port an application from one platform to another, what we've discovered is that very often most of the work is not in changing proprietary interfaces to fit the new platform that you're moving to, but just in finding them. If you've got a 250,000 lines of code out there, and scattered throughout all of that code are various interfaces to proprietary turbo image call, file systems calls, whatever they might be, finding all of those is usually the hard part. Once you've found them, changing them is relatively straightforward. So we'd strongly suggest that you keep the operating system calls localized. That's what professional application developers are doing today, collecting all of those into a single library where they can be found easily.
Okay, well, let's get a little deeper into POSIX. You said it's a family of standards, but it's somewhat limited in what it offers. What's included here? I know some of this is listed on page 16.
Right. We've given you here a partial list of the POSIX standards that are being developed by the IEEE committees that I mentioned. Now, the interesting thing is out of the 11 standards that we've listed here, and by the way, this is not exhaustive, there are many, many more, the only ones that have been finalized to date are the POSIX .1 and .2 standards, or what's listed here is 1003.1 and 1003.2. And as you can see, that's a standard for the C programming language and for shell commands, being the Unix equivalent of the kinds of commands that you would type, for example, on an MPE system to a colon prompt. The rest of these are still under development by the IEEE committees. For example, in the area of security, there's a lot of argument about the best way to enforce security on an industry standard system. Supercomputing, Fortran, all of these are still under development. So at this time on MPE, the only two standards that we've begun to implement are the .1 and .2. As more standards become finalized, we will look at addressing those as well.
Now, does integrating .1 and .2 into MPX, does that offering new functionality to MPX, or what's really the impact?
Well, not really. There's not a lot of new functionality in MPE. Remember that what these standards represent really are just a standardized method of doing things that all operating systems do and have always done. So, for example, if you look on page 17, down at the bottom of the page there, we've divided up the POSIX functionality into six broad categories, and this follows the IEEE documentation and the way IEEE divides this stuff up exactly. So if you look at these six categories, the first one is called signals, and that's a way, for example, of application programs to communicate with one another and to control one another's execution. And it's exactly the sort of thing that we've done on MPE for years with intrinsics, such as XCONTRAP, XArrayTrap, suspend, and activate. So once again, it doesn't represent new functionality so much as it represents a different way of doing the things that we've already been able to do on MPE. Similarly, backup facilities, the second category, is nothing new to MPE. A terminal interface to allow you to read and write data from a terminal. Process management, file management, all of this is old stuff to us. About the only thing that's really dramatically new to the MPE environment are the directory services that are in this sixth category. In the past, we've never had a hierarchical directory structure such as you would find on a Unix system, or for that matter, even on an MS-DOS system, with subdirectories and subdirectories below that and so forth. So that represents new functionality and is currently only found on 4.5, the POSIX, the first POSIX release of MPE.
Okay, well, so we'll position POSIX then as the leading interface to the operating system. What about databases? I mean, I think as you noted, George, very few applications today don't have some kind of database interface.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that's happened actually over the last 15 years, this has been evolving. Database standards are certainly nothing new. With the emergence of relational databases, one of the key values that brings, of course, is that the interface to the database has become standardized. The ANSI SQL standard that we mentioned on page 18 represents a standardized way to read and write data in and out of a database. Now, the trick with the SQL standard, however, is that most commercial applications do a lot more with databases than simply read and write data. So the ANSI SQL standard all by itself is not really enough. It goes a long way towards standardizing database interfaces, but it's not really broad enough to cover all database access types out of a commercial application. Now, some of the other standards, for example, that address database access include the ones at the bottom of the page here, ODBC, and the GUPTA SQL APIs. Both of these represent they represent two different ways of doing fundamentally the same thing. If you had an application that was running on a PC and it used the ANSI SQL statements to access a database, you could pretty well guess that that the database would be on the same platform as the program. However, what if you wanted that application program running on the PC to access a database on another platform someplace out in the network, perhaps on a server somewhere? Well, that's what ODBC and the GUPTA APIs do. It allows you to, it allows an application program running on one platform to access a database running on another platform. And here's the good part. The real payoff is that the application doesn't need to worry about what kind of database that is over on the server, whether it's a third-party database such as an Oracle or a Sybase or Ingress or one of those, or whether it's a proprietary database such as a Turbo Image or even a database, a relational database such as Allbase. It really doesn't matter. Now, you put those standards together with ANSI SQL, and you begin to really have something. And as a matter of fact, XOpen is in the process of putting together a standard that they call SQL Access, which really consists of ANSI SQL, ODBC, as well as a third component, RDA, the Remote Data Access Standard, which is based on a standard from ANSI. But once again, this is an area where standards are still emerging as the database market continues to evolve.
Well, Kurt, if you read the trade press, or look at the advertisements in the trade press, you would get the impression that many of the database vendors are claiming that they're the standard in this area.
Well, yeah, that's a claim that a lot of people will make, and it's certainly good. It's a good marketing story. But as a matter of fact, if you look at the statistics, I think you'll see that none of the leading database vendors really have the critical mass required to be able to stand up and say that they own the bulk of the marketplace, except perhaps in individual segments of the market, perhaps on a PC or perhaps in the Unix environment. But nobody really has the critical mass to stand up and say that they represent a true standard for the industry. So I think what most of the database vendors, particularly the portable database vendors that run on multiple platforms, have are products that are truly proprietary. That is, once you start using those products, you are tied not to a hardware platform. Remember, the whole idea of the Unix open systems thing was to get away from being tied to a hardware platform. But now what we've got is people that have tied themselves to a software platform, to a particular database or fourth-generation language, because they're making extensive use of proprietary interfaces to that particular database. So if you're tied to that database, sure, you can have the database on a DEC VAX or on a HP 3000 or 9000 or whatever it might be. But if you look at the cost of the database, and it turns out the database is costing you more than the hardware is, then I submit to you it doesn't make much difference what hardware platform you're running on. The chief cost that you're trying to reduce has become the software, and that's the proprietary piece of the puzzle in that particular environment. So we look at these things, and I tend to identify them as being not open so much as proprietary, but portable.
Okay. And I think as we go on here, particularly when we start to get into 4GLs, we're going to see other cases where situations like that exist, where really portability is a trade-off as to who you want to be reliant on for which pieces of the solution. Let's move on to the next area of standards, networking standards. On page 19, we've listed out some of them. George, can you explain some of these?
Sure. There are four of them listed on page 19. The first is Berkeley sockets, and it probably represents the closest thing we have to a networking least common denominator for application program interfaces. It runs over a wide variety of networking platforms, probably the most widely used on TCP/IP, but it's available on many, many others. And it is very, very generic, and it's also very simple and low level. Basically, what Berkeley sockets allows you to do is to package up some data into a packet and send that packet out across the network, where you are responsible for writing application code that runs on another platform someplace in the network that will pick up that packet, open it up, take the data out, and then know what to do with it. That's fine, but it's considerably less in the way of functionality than many customers are asking for today. The emerging standards in the networking industry are things that are coming from companies such as Novell with their NetWare products, and these are for applications that want to do much more than just send a packet of data across the network, but you want to be able to do things like share files across the system, share disk drives, share printers, So for applications that need to communicate between NetWare servers and NetWare clients, Novell is a fine alternative to look at today. Now, the interesting thing is that most people tend to think of Novell as a PC platform, but that's really changing very quickly. For example, with the NetWare 3000 product that's out there today, an HP 3000 can be configured to run as a server in a Novell NetWare marketplace, in a Novell NetWare network. And what that means is that you can get all of the functionality and performance of the HP 3000 and still all the functionality that you get out of NetWare for your PC-type networks. Similarly, in the Apple Macintosh arena, the Apple Share APIs will allow you to do much the same sort of thing with a network of Macintosh clients, and we're very happy to announce that Apple Share's APIs will be supported on the HP 3000 in the first half of 1994. In the IBM mainframe marketplace, IBM system network architecture includes standards called Logical Unit 6.2, Physical Unit 2.1. These are widely supported, but they are pretty programmer intensive. You only have to listen to the names, I guess, and you get an idea that these are not very straightforward. So they will allow you a wide variety of connectivity and functionality, but you can figure that you're going to keep your programmers busy with this sort of thing.
Okay, well, hopefully this discussion has clearly laid out the standards that are really required for portable applications. And as you can see, there's not necessarily a lot of options to choose from. For an operating system interface, POSIX is going to be the best bet, working with C. For a database interface, something that supports ANSI SQL, and if you're doing the database calls over the network, either the Gupta API or the ODBC. Networking standards, you've got a little more flexibility. Start with Berkeley sockets as your least common denominator, then take additional packages as necessary that meet your needs. But I think it is important to keep in mind a comment that George made earlier, and that is that not everything you need to do in an application can be accomplished with the standard definitions. They simply aren't comprehensive enough to cover all aspects of every application program. You are at times going to need to write to the specific operating system or the specific environment, whether that be MPIX or some other environment, in order to perform all the functions you need. And the key there is going to be to manage that carefully, keep that segregated in a way that you can easily come back and change it when you need to move the application to another platform. George, let's go back to the original evaluation criteria laid out a few minutes ago and talk in more detail. How does a 3GL, given what we've been discussing, stack up against this?
Well, Dave, you recall we mentioned six different areas. They're listed starting on page 20, so let's go through them one at a time. First of all, performance, 3GLs tend to do very, very well. And this is perhaps the clearest area where you can really differentiate 3GLs from 4GLs, because hardware vendors typically do a very good job of optimizing their compilers around their specific hardware platform. Certainly HP spends a lot of time on that. You can usually pretty well bet that the 3GL is potentially at least going to outperform the 4GL. Now, of course, that doesn't take into account programming practices that, you know, specific programming practices that might not work very well on a particular platform. But as a general rule, 3GLs tend to do extraordinarily well. 4GLs, on the other hand, because they're built as an additional layer on top of a 3GL, you would really have a very difficult time getting to that level of performance. They're much better than they used to be, but I still think you can do better in a 3GL today. Time to market, on the other hand, 3GLs suffer a definite disadvantage here. Writing applications in a third-generation language still remains, as it says here, a handcrafted approach. That means that the programmer productivity tools are relatively few and far between. The learning curve can be quite steep, although training in third-generation languages has gotten to be relatively easy to come by. Most even community colleges today offer some sort of programmer training in Unix and C, and that's very applicable in an open systems environment, even on the 3000 today. The cost of third-generation languages tends to be relatively low. You don't have a whole lot that you have to buy in order to get started, so that gives 3GLs a definite advantage. Flexibility with third-generation languages is excellent because the compilers are typically written by the hardware vendors. They usually take full advantage of all of the features that are available on that particular hardware platform. There are some exceptions to that, of course. But what that means to you, of course, is that if you're interested in application portability, it's sort of a caveat emptor situation. Let the buyer beware of the fact that the more you take advantage of features of an individual platform, the more difficult it's going to be for you to port that application to another platform sometime in the future. The next category on page 21 is end-user ease of use. And this is a reference, of course, to things like graphical user interfaces. And in one sense, this is sort of a wash between the two platforms. You can do just about anything with a third-generation language in terms of graphical user interfaces that you can with a fourth-generation language. The difference being, though, is that the development times in 4GLs tend to be a whole lot lower. So, in other words, implementing a GUI-type interface in a 3GL tends to be pretty time-consuming to develop, and we've seen a lot of projects where that feature is dropped in order to improve time to market. Finally, vendor independence. 3GLs are widely supported by leading vendors, and as long as you, programmer, are scrupulous about observing the standards, we've even talked to some people who've told us that the best approach is to throw out the manual you get from your hardware vendor and replace it with a generic manual that you get from a standards body such as IEEE. If you do that, then you can achieve vendor independence, but remember, it's up to you to do that. And also don't forget that you're not only interested in achieving independence from your hardware vendor, but also from any particular software vendor that you might be involved with at this point.
Okay, well, George, if this strategy looks like the right one for Entry 2000 customer, what do they need to get started?
Well, the first thing you need to do, of course, is to plan. You want to make sure that you isolate the operating system calls in a single library so that you can find them later. If you need to modify the application, as we mentioned, make sure that you separate proprietary OS calls from standard OS calls. But in terms of products, there's really only three things you need to worry about. The first, on the 3000 at least, is the HP 3000 POSIX Developers Kit. And this fundamentally consists of the C compiler and the POSIX libraries, the compile time libraries that go with it. It does require the use of release 4.5 of MPE or a later release. Subsequent releases, of course, will support POSIX functionality. You also need an SQL-compliant database. In the old days, this meant all base SQL, but as most of you are probably aware of, the Image SQL upgrade now brings Turbo Image into this exact same arena so that you can access existing Turbo Image databases that you've already been using in an industry standard way. And finally, if you're going to be in a networked environment, and who isn't these days, you're going to need some sort of HP 3000 networking link product, such as the FinLAN link. Berkeley Sockets is included as part of that product. NetWare, AppleShare, and Logical Unit 6.2, all of these standards are available on the 3000 as separate products. So that's pretty much it. There's your shopping list, and that should be plenty to get you started.
Okay, well, George, thank you. And that's basically going to conclude our discussion of 3GLs. We're going to give George a break. If you have questions for him, make a note of them. He'll be back at the end to answer your questions. So at this point, then, we want to shift our focus to the second of our two strategies, and that is fourth-generation languages. And we have a new expert joining us for that section, Dave Wild. Dave is part of HP's product planning organization. His focus really is on the tools and environments that are used for developing open client-server applications. So, Dave, we talked briefly about kind of the general in general terms, the difference between 3GLs and 4GLs. When it comes right down to it, what's really the difference between the two?
Well, David, there are really two key differences when you compare 3GLs with 4GLs. The first one is that the language itself that you're developing in tends to be more abstract, much like going from assembly languages to 3GL gave you a level of abstraction that added a lot of efficiencies in terms of ease of use and ease of programming. Moving from a 3GL to a 4GL in terms of the language gives you that. But more significantly, when you go to a 4GL, one of the key benefits you get is that you get much more than just that language. You get it really with an integrated toolkit. And so it lets you manage much more than just your application logic. It lets you manage your networking in the case of doing client-server in more of an automated fashion. It really takes care of that problem for you. And it gives you more of an integrated environment in terms of developing your graphical environment if you're working in a graphical user interface. The key goals here, of course, first of all, are easier development and maintenance for your applications. And secondly, there's a goal here of portability in that you can develop your application in a 4GL environment. And because of the abstraction that a 4GL environment gives you, it makes it easier to port to different environments.
Okay, well, Dave, well, what kind of capabilities can customers expect to find in this integrated environment? I know you've listed some of them out on page 24.
Okay, if you look at some of the things that are listed there, of course, there's things like screen painters and graphical user interface tools, as I mentioned, that help you with your forms painting as well as a windowing environment, either on a terminal or in a Windows or a Macintosh environment, for example. In addition to that, there are tools for report writing. And a lot of the 4GLs are also including tools now for things like data dictionaries and repositories to allow you to aid your development environment and things like that. They also, as you move into client-server, the database network access tends to be handled by the combination of the 4GL vendor and or the database vendor. And that's a big change. We find that maintaining a client-server environment, trying to do your own networking can be very complex and very expensive. There are integration capabilities with other tools that you might be using in your environment. Many of the 4GLs also include end-user query tools besides just the 4GL language. And again, the key advantages here are that all of these have a common look and feel. In the environment that George was talking about with the 3GL, you can integrate different tools yourself, but they all have different look and feels, and it's more difficult to learn, more difficult to maintain. They're all designed to work together, and finally, they're supported as a unit, which means in terms of getting support for any defects you might have or getting training, it all comes from one vendor.
Well, I think what the point you just made, I guess, is the kind of the key difference when it comes right down to it, that the 4GL is one-stop shopping, everything in one package from one place. Whereas the 3GL is more of a kind of mix and match and build it yourself.
That's exactly right. It allows you to pick the best in terms of the hardware environment, your client-server environment, database environment, et cetera. And one of the real advantages there is that single-vendor integration for the software developer.
Okay. Hey, well, Dave, we heard George's version of kind of the evaluation of 3GLs and 4GLs. Let's hear your version. At page 25, you've documented that.
Sure. Of course, it's very difficult in this environment because products vary so widely. It's still a fairly new field, and there's a lot of ways that different vendors differentiate themselves, so it's difficult to make a blanket comparison. However, if you look at the categories on performance, as George mentioned, because of the flexibility you get with a 3GL, 4GLs will not outperform what you could do with a 3GL, but they do come close in some cases. In other cases, because of the abstraction it gives you, you may get a lot of benefits in terms of portability, but there may be a big price to pay in performance, so it's something you need to be aware of. In terms of time to market, because of the fact that you have an integrated environment at your fingertips when you're developing, time to market tends to be much better in a 4GL environment. We hear that consistently from our customers that are using 4GLs. On the cost side, this varies quite a bit among vendors. 4GL environments, because of the vast array of capabilities they give you, can be very expensive. On the other hand, there are some products out there on the market now, particularly in a PC environment, that can be very inexpensive, either in terms of the development licensing cost or in terms of the runtime licensing cost. So 3GLs do tend to be less expensive, but again, there's quite a range there. In terms of flexibility, nothing really beats the 3GL environment for that because you can put together all of the different components that you want to customize your environment. You can control the messages that are flowing over the network in a client-server environment. You have much more access to the features in the database, so you're giving up potentially flexibility and potentially quite a bit of flexibility as you move into a 4GL environment. In the area of end-user ease of use, again, because of this integration that you get across the toolkit, it tends to be much easier to use. All the different components are designed to work together, whereas you're putting your own model together in a 3GL environment. And finally, in the area of vendor independence, many 4GL vendors today, in order to be competitive, are running across different platforms. And by different platforms, we're talking about database, networking, client platforms, as well as server, hardware, and operating system platforms. So you can get quite a bit of vendor independence, but again, you give something up in terms of going with a model that, in order to be portable, may not have the tight integration that you're looking for.
Okay, well, David, if this sounds like a good strategy, what's needed to get started?
The key things that you need to get started are actually quite varied, and what we suggest there is that you work with with the vendor of your 4GL environment to understand what they're looking for. So as you're going through an evaluation and using some of the criteria we'll be talking about later, different vendors will require different pieces depending on what your environment is, what networking, database, hardware environments you're looking at. et cetera. So we really encourage you to work with the individual vendors to understand that, because it's too complex to talk about in a short period of time.
Okay. And I think this fact is what's going to make the discussion that we're about to have on 4GLs quite a bit different from the discussion we had on 3GLs. Because whereas in 3GLs it's more of a function of defining the standards that you're going to have to choose from, with 4GLs you're getting everything packaged together at once. So the key decision you're having to make, and this is an evaluation you have to go through, is which 4GL package is going to best meet your needs, which offers what you're looking for. And that's what we want to focus on for the next few minutes. If you'll turn to page 28 in your slide packet, you'll see what we've tried to do in terms of kind of setting up a framework. And really, the reason this is so important is that when you move to a 4GL, you are becoming as reliant on your 4GL vendor as you are on the applications you're developing with that 4GL. So you really need to be sure that this is a partnership that's going to work, both from a technical and from a business standpoint. I mean, we really may be overstating the obvious here, but you really, before launching into this, it's critical that you sit down and find out what it is you're setting out to achieve. Are you looking to reduce time to market? Are you looking to reduce development expenses? Are you trying to gain a competitive advantage from your applications? Are you trying to re-engineer your business critical functions? What really are you trying to do? These are the kinds of issues to keep in mind when you're evaluating a 4GL. You really need to take the responsibility up front for careful planning, a definition of requirements, and then work with the individual 4GL vendors to find out in detail how well they can meet your specific requirements. The framework on page 28 is designed as a way to kind of walk you through some of the key considerations in this evaluation process. There's four areas that we suggest you look at. First is business considerations, the stability and long-term viability of the vendor. Is this someone you want to partner with long-term? Second is openness. Does the 4GL support the clients, the servers, the databases, the networking that you expect to have as part of your environment? Third is computing models. There are different ways of structuring your application. If you've chosen a particular way to structure your application, does the 4GL support that same way of structuring the application? And the final area at the bottom there is actually functionality considerations and performance. So if you'll just make a note of that change on your slide, it reads performance on your slide right now, and that really should read functionality considerations and performance. And that's why there's the set of functionality and the set of tools and added value that Dave mentioned. Is that the right set for you that the particular vendor offers? Now, this is not necessarily the comprehensive list. You may have unique requirements that are not reflected here, but we've found for many customers, in fact, you'll hear about this in our case study, a framework like this is a good basis for an informed decision. So what we want to do now is look individually at each of these areas. So we're going to start on page 29 with business considerations. And Dave, I think the thing that's interesting here is that this is really part of any application selection, isn't it? I mean, what's really different looking at 4GLs?
Well, it absolutely is the same here. I think what we need to point out here is that as you look at 4GLs, there's a wide range of business problems you can attack with a 4GL. On the one hand, you could use a 4GL for some of the ad hoc work that you're doing, things that may not be as mission critical or as strategic as some of your areas where you're trying to gain a competitive advantage. But on the other hand, you might be deciding to use a 4GL environment for doing all of your application development across the board. And if that's the case, an area of things like vendor stability and paying attention to pricing and licensing can be one of the most critical decisions you make. In fact, what we're seeing is our customers developing much more at the 4GL level and investing much more in terms of their software development effort. This is an area that can be more important in some cases than your choice of database or operating system because you have such a big investment there. So the areas listed here, vendor stability, training, support, and pricing and licensing, are the same as kind of things you'd look at for any piece of software. But again, you just need to be careful if you're standardizing on a 4GL for a large part of your development. You know, it's absolutely critical that you look at some of the issues like licensing and things like that.
Okay. And I think just to clear up a point that came up in our earlier comments yesterday, this is not to suggest at all that 4GLs are inappropriate for strategic and mission-critical applications. They certainly are. It's just that you need to treat the selection of the 4GL with the same importance that you treat those mission-critical applications. The second point on our framework was this concept of openness. What do we mean by openness in the context of a 4GL, really, and what should people be looking for?
Okay, in the area of 4GL environments, again, particular to your entire your particular company and what you're trying to accomplish. You may be down the road looking at running on top of different network transports if you're moving into client-server and different client platforms. The same thing applies for database management systems and for hardware servers, both the hardware itself as well as the operating system. So you need to look at your particular environment and understand what databases you want to run against over the next number of years where you expect your applications to be existing. You need to understand what clients you want to support, what networking, and then make sure that the vendor or vendors that you choose will support the environments that you're looking at. If you look at the next slide, there's a sample, for example, of what you might find when you go talk to a particular vendor in terms of the client platforms that are supported, in terms of the presentation manager and the operating system. Same thing for the database, the server operating system, and although networks aren't shown on the slide, there's that aspect of as well in terms of transports like TCP/IP or SPX/IPX. So what's absolutely critical is that, first of all, you make sure that if one of your goals is portability, so that you wanted to be able to develop, for example, on terminals to run against Allbase on an HP platform, but you also wanted to be able to run those terminal applications on Windows or move the database over to Oracle or something like that, that you have that kind of portability. This can be a double-edged sword. You don't necessarily want to go for more portability than you need, because what will happen there is that vendor will spend a lot of time testing on those different platforms, firstly. Secondly, the functionality that they support needs to potentially be a least common denominator for all those platforms. So you may be giving something up. So you really want to go for as much openness as you need, but not necessarily anymore.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's look at the third area, computing models. Now, I guess to introduce this, when we talk about computing models, really we're talking about the way in which an application is structured, and that is how is the processing handled, how is the user interface handled, and what traffic is passing across the network. And on page 32, we have a rather complicated diagram, courtesy of Gartner Group, illustrating some of the models that are in use in the marketplace. Can you kind of talk us through this there?
Yeah, this is actually, we're going to go through a discussion now on the next four slides where we talk a little bit about underneath your application, when you use a 4GL, in a client-server environment, all the 4GLs break up the application or allow you some flexibility, potentially, in terms of what actually gets passed over the network. In other cases, you have no flexibility or control as to what goes over the network. And that could be absolutely critical in terms of performance characteristics that you'll see for your application in terms of what's flowing over the wire. So rather than go into detail on this slide, we have three slides later that talk about this, but the key issue here is that when you're using a 4GL for your application environment, you may have little visibility into what's going over the network except when you see the performance characteristics. So it's very important that you understand this in terms of the kind of flexibility it'll give you and down the road the kind of performance that it might give you. Okay. Going on to the first of the three slides where we talk about this is the remote presentation model. This is slide number 33. And this model